You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Evan Johns. I represent the appellants in this case and the petitioners below, Transparent GMU and Augustus Thompson. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. We're asking this court to reverse a series of decisions that, taken together, have the practical effect of allowing any agency in the Commonwealth to avoid their disclosure obligations under the Freedom of Information Act merely by outsourcing one of their essential functions to a private corporation. Today, I'd specifically like to emphasize three of the errors that the court committed below. The first was the court's ruling that serving as the primary depository for donations to a governmental agency is not a form of public business under the Act. The second error was the court's holding that there's no means of accessing a certain class of records. Here, those are records held by an agent of a public body in the transaction of public business, that the public has no means of accessing those records despite the fact that they're designated as public under the Act. And the third error is the court's ruling that records used by a government officer are not subject to the Act if a private entity holds paper title to those records or it uses them in another private capacity. Because there's several diverse issues in this case, I think it's good to start with first principles. There's really three questions in an enforcement action under the Act. The first is whether the records requested were public records, whether they meet the statutory definition that the General Assembly has enacted. The second is, if they are public records, who is the custodian who's responsible for providing access to those records? And finally, whether the General Assembly has seen fit to enact a specific statutory exemption that would allow redaction or withholding of those records.
May I ask you this? If RFP, our 1994 opinion, were replayed today after the 2001 amendment to 3701, if exactly the same facts, exactly the same circumstances were replayed today, would the result be the same after the 2001 amendment to the statute?
And Justice Kelsey, are you referring to the amendment to the definition of public body or to the definition of public record?
The former, the other entity language that was added that is asserted to be a mere scrivener's additional clerical addition to a recodified statute.
Certainly, Justice Kelsey. We believe that the analysis the court used is unnecessary given the 2001 revision to the definition of a public body. It would no longer be necessary to pierce the corporate veil or to establish an alter ego relationship because a class of public bodies that have a separate legal identity were included within that definition.
So the 2001 amendment with the other entity, however designated language, under your interpretation, since it would have reversed RFP, was an expansion of the definition of public body.
That's correct.
One, not some recodification wordsmithing issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that the language of the statute is unambiguous. And I think any effort to look behind the plain language that the legislature saw fit to use in that definition is inappropriate.
But then let me follow up with this. The tradition, you may have text on your side, but tradition is very much against you. And it's a pretty powerful tradition. Is the text strong enough to overcome it?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, we believe it is. Certainly, we think that it may be the case that that there has been a tradition of considering these as separate entities, but it's also the case that the General Assembly can craft legislation in any way it sees fit. It certainly could have added university foundations as a specific type of public body under the Act, but that's not the route the legislature chose. The General Assembly instead chose to use this generic category of an agent of a public body, adopting the common law test, and we believe that in certain circumstances, including this case, that would include university foundations. In other words, there's no university foundation exclusion from the general categorical language that the legislature
One argument on the other side of that is, how could the General Assembly have contemplated that, let's say, a law firm that's retained by the university, a PR firm, a janitorial service, a construction company, because they're doing work on behalf of the university, now they're subject to FOIA? Did they really contemplate that? What's your response to that?
I think the General Assembly clearly contemplated that anywhere where the government has the ability to control the actions of a contracting party, where there's a true agency relationship, they made the determination that as a general rule, we extend disclosure to those entities.
I mean, I've just never seen that. I've never seen a FOIA request to a law firm, hey, you're working on behalf of the university, or, you know, whatever. I mean, just that would be a sea change, and maybe you're right textually.
It would certainly have to be within the scope of the agency relationship, and it would also have to relate to the transaction of public business. So we wouldn't say that a snack bar at the football stadium would necessarily be subject. It's questionable whether there would be the requisite control in that relationship either.
So your point is that by encouraging, if not outright directing, public universities to seek private funds, then ipso facto, it's a delegated function if they farm it out to someone else.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think the both the affiliation agreement between the two entities at issue in this case and the statutory provisions in Chapter 23.1 say that ultimately it's the board of directors' responsibility for managing these funds coming in. Clearly, they're given the right to delegate that to another entity, but that's precisely the kind of relationship that we believe the definition of public body includes. Starting with that question of public business,
Council,
I think it's...
Council, before you
yes.
get there, actually my interest is piqued by your statement that the snack bar at the stadium wouldn't be covered. The reason you have a foundation is because the state doesn't give universities enough money to do the job that they want to do. The reason why a university, and those are big dollars, the reason why a university would give a license for a snack bar at stadiums because they want a certain amount of the proceeds. Those are small dollars. That's the only distinction that I can think of in terms of the statutory language. Why would any other money, well, I say money raising activity, how do you draw the line where you're not to say, well, the language would include a foundation, because as you said, it's an essential function, but it wouldn't include numerous commercial activities that universities engage in that brings money to the university. How do we draw that line, or do we not draw that line? Do we say that the door is open, any and every document relating to funds coming into a university is now subject to FOIA?
Well, it's certainly not our position, Your Honor, that any and every document would be subject to FOIA. I think that the legislature has already set the guideposts here. There needs to be the existence of an agency relationship, and it needs to relate to the transaction of public business. And there are several tests that the court can use in determining what constitutes public business. The court's traditionally taken a rather broad approach. I believe Tolby v. Brown is the primary case in this context. But I think one question the court could ask is this a function that the public body would need to do itself if not for the existence of an agent that it has contracted this duty out to? I'm not sure a snack bar would fit that definition of public business, but I certainly...
Dollars are fungible. We're talking hundreds of millions with foundations. We might only be talking thousands with... the snack bar is almost the absurd example. But modern universities engage in numerous commercial or fundraising or revenue producing activities, and all of which at some level benefit the university's function. I'm understanding your argument, and I'm respecting your argument. I need to know what the limiting principle is. That's what it boils down to.
Well, there's a few principles that would limit it here. To first start with your question about why fundraising is different, I think that courts who have looked at this question, including the Supreme Court of Ohio, have noted the fact that these private donations can have a significant effect on the actual pedagogical functions at a university. And that alone should put fundraising over the edge into the realm of public business, because suddenly we are talking about the primary core function of these universities.
Money is power, and power is able to direct a lot of things, much more so than a concession stand.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
May I ask you about 3705.47A7, fundraising activities, this is the exemption, by or for a public institution of higher education. Fundraising activities by, which would be the school doing it itself, by its, but for, how can that not be talking about someone other than the university itself?
Exactly, Your Honor. That is exactly how the statute should be read, and that's even more true when you turn a few pages in the code book and look at the only other fundraising exemption, that is 2.2-3705.7, and that refers to information maintained in connection with fundraising activities by the Veterans Service Foundation. No or for in that instance. And I think this is a recognition by the General Assembly that these are functions that are outsourced to other entities, and yet they still constitute public business for which the General Assembly needs to craft a statutory exemption for.
Counsel, before, I don't want to be like a terrier worrying over a bone, but I want to give one other example that is not a snack bar.
Certainly.
It is somewhat larger dollars than a snack bar, but I think is the sort of thing that may be implicated, and maybe we want it to be implicated, and that is the contracts that universities have with, university athletic departments have with entities such as Nike or Under Armour or other entities of that nature, which are many, many, many millions of dollars, and which I'm wondering, are they subject to FOIA?
I believe so, Your Honor. Are you referring to specific contractual relations with a sponsor like Nike and the university itself or the athletic?
The university's athletic foundation enters into a contract with Nike, Under Armour, whomever, for relating to shoes, relating to apparel, et cetera. Is that subject to FOIA? And I make no value judgment in asking the question. Maybe it should be, maybe it shouldn't be. Again, I'm simply testing the limits of where this argument takes it.
Certainly, Your Honor. Of course, in that circumstance, we don't get to the question of agency, right? But as to the public business question, I believe it would. I guess I'm not as familiar with that aspect of university operations, but it's my understanding that operating athletic facilities is an important part of operating a modern university, and I believe that's generally recognized in other cases.
Okay. Before we get to the exemption in 3705.47, would we have to answer the question whether these are public records, and if so, what would be your answer as to what makes them public records?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's important to keep in mind that actually the question of whether these records in this case are statutorily exempt is not at issue. No statutory exemption was invoked below, either in the response to the initial FOIA request or in the proceedings in front of the circuit court. There's never been a contention that the records requested, although there's been an acknowledgement that they exist, that they fall within one of those statutory exemptions. So really, I think that the importance of that statutory exemption is really just to illuminate what the General Assembly has in mind when they're defining what constitutes public business, how we scope the FOIA Act.
Okay.
to the agency claims at issue in this case, again, I think the statutory definition is dispositive here. The plain language, and it's phrased in the dispositive, so there is a class of records that are considered public records that are the disclosure is a right of the public to, that are never possessed by the public body itself. They are prepared, possessed, or owned by an agent of the public body transacting public business. I think it's important that this was a claim that was dismissed on demur. The circuit court did never actually undertake an inquiry into whether the foundation serves as an agent of the university. It just held that there's essentially no way to access these records because neither the university nor the foundation, even if they're public records, could be considered the custodian who's responsible for providing access. We believe that's an absurdity that the General Assembly simply could not have intended. And 15 years of advisory opinions, circuit court decisions, and an attorney general opinion have all found that the public body is considered the custodian of the records that its agents hold on its behalf. The General Assembly has never corrected that interpretation of the Act, even though members of the General Assembly, as you all know, sit on the Advisory Council. Finally, on the question of whether Dr. Bingham, who concurrently serves as the Vice President of Advancement at the University and the President and CEO of the Foundation, whether she had possession of these records in her capacity as a university officer, I think the allegations in the complaint clearly set out a claim that she possesses them in her capacity as a university officer. It acknowledged her concurrent roles in both of those organizations. It acknowledged that she performs fundraising activities in both capacities and that she uses the documents in question in both of those, in performing those activities.
Was that specific allegation the subject of the demur that was granted?
It was, Your Honor. Yes, it was. And I would also direct the court's attention to the recent decision in Our Lady of the Peace. In the tort context, this court has held that the mere allegation of an employment relationship kind of carries the issue of scope of agency or scope of employment through the demur stage and into factual development. While, strictly speaking, that doctrine might not apply in FOIA cases, the underlying rationale is exactly the same. And we see no reason why a different rule should apply in FOIA cases.
Well, you alleged your specific scope of employment in the vicarious liability context. We allow the inference of scope of employment even without the specific allegation.
That's correct, Your Honor. So I believe we've gone above and beyond what the law requires in the tort context.
You wanted to save 3 minutes. You're down to 2:45.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Matt Fitzgerald for the George Mason University Foundation. We're splitting time equally between the foundation and the university today, so at 10 minutes, if not before, I would like to turn it over to my friend, the Solicitor General.
May I ask you, if RFP were exactly before us in this session of court this week, exact facts, no different, but now that we're on the other side of the 2001 amendment, would the result be the same or different?
It would be the same.
Wow.
So first, actually, a little bit more history might benefit this. After RF&P, between 1993 and 97, the General Assembly amended FOIA to actually speak directly to RF&P Corporation itself. So the text of the statute immediately after that case came down at the time that it was being ruled on addressed RF&P, and then in 1997 it came back out. The core of RF&P...
I'm not sure why that has anything to do with anything.
Well, I think it shows, Your Honor, that the amendment made in 2001 was not intended to be a response to RF&P.
Well, just read amendment in 2001 literally, and then my question is, in your professional judgment, would the court's opinion be exactly the same?
I think it would, Your Honor. And the reason is, it is still, the core of RF&P is a separate corporation, is not within the public body if it is a separate corporation.
Wasn't it a wholly owned corporation of the public body?
Yes, it was.
And you don't think that would be covered by the other entity, however designated, language of the 2001 amendment?
So that is a close question, which isn't presented in this case because the foundation is not controlled by the university.
But it is presented because your main argument against the text is that it was just a recodification, wordsmithing. Don't worry about it. Just keep on. Don't look this way. They're looking at it pretty carefully and reading it literally. And then they're adding, if there's any ambiguity, they get the benefit of the call. Ties go to the runner in FOIA. But your response is, don't read it too carefully because it didn't do anything. It's just wordsmithing.
No, Your Honor. My response is, the foundation is a separate corporate entity. It is not an entity of the university. And so ultimately, this comes down to two, because the university is clearly a public body, the case against the foundation comes down to two questions, I think. First, is the foundation part of the university, which is it an entity of the university under the modern text of the statute? And the answer to that is no. It's a separate corporation. That's what's been recognized by the Attorney General opinions, the FOIA Advisory Council opinions, including under the 2001 version of the statute.
So what does other entity, however designated, however constructed, however lawyered?
Your Honor, I believe the best reading of that is it means other things that are not called committees or subcommittees, but that are similar to those, subparts of the university.
Well, if we're supposed to use a liberal as opposed to a strict construction, why would we go to the narrow interpretation? Why wouldn't we go to the broader interpretation?
Well, I think that it's the proper interpretation under the context provided by the statute. I mean, if you're asking what's the difference between, say, a committee and a subcommittee, it's basically the name and what it's called. And so in the context of this recodification, where the description of it was no meaningful change is intended, to say, or other entity, however designated, I think the best reading is committee, subcommittee, or working group thing like a committee, whatever they call it.
Well, the operative point has to be out of the university. So you could call it a think tank, you could call it a research center. I thought the point was, we don't care about nomenclature. If you're of the university, disclose it, and if you're not, then you don't have to.
Correct, and we're not of the university. So the first question is, are we part of the university? Are we an entity of the university? And we're not. We're a separate corporation that existed, was created by the foundation, existed before the university did, existed before FOIA as well. And then the second question is the agency question, which is, well, does the university control the foundation? And the answer to that is no also.
Isn't the problem whether the foundation controls the university?
Whether the foundation controls the university?
Isn't that the policy behind FOIA, is to find out if something like that might be going on?
No, Your Honor. I mean, it just comes from the general principles of agency that if, in order to reach the foundation under FOIA, once the foundation is not a public body, the question is, are we an agent of a public body? Which comes down to, are we controlled by the public body? And we have here a fact-finding after the trial that the foundation is, quote, operating independently from the university under its own articles and bylaws.
The knotty issue, though, is Dr. Bingham, the vice president, assignment of error 4. So before your time is up, would you address that in the context of not only agency, but the overall argument?
Also, you have obviously reached some agreement, but it looks to me like it's going to be strained in a few seconds as far as the involvement of the Attorney General's office. Handle it accordingly.
Yes, Your Honor. So, obviously, both the university and the foundation can speak to Janet Bingham's position. She is the president of the foundation. She is also a university employee. There is nothing on its face improper about that. It is not an uncommon sort of arrangement between universities and foundations. It does not show that the university controls the foundation. The testimony at the trial was that the foundation is controlled by its board of trustees, the vast majority of whom have no formal affiliation with the university whatsoever. Ms. Bingham reports to them, and at the trial, which there was a trial in this matter, it lasted a full day, it was well aired out whether the university controlled the foundation or not. That issue persisted beyond the dismissal of the university, because after all, there was a count pleading agency against the foundation, count five, and the trial court acknowledged that evidence going to that count could be relevant to what would be tried, and he would allow it. So the parties in their pretrial briefs briefed whether the agency, whether the university controlled the foundation.
But outside of agency, to the extent that there are records under her control in her office, and she has a dual capacity, how is it possible to say, again, I'm looking almost for a limiting principle, I'm looking at how do you determine what record she holds as a foundation employee or a foundation agent and which one she holds as a university agent?
So I think it's important to, her two positions are different and meaningfully different. I mean, in her role for the university, she is a fundraiser. She goes out, meets with people, tries to solicit donations, strategizes that for the university. Her position for the foundation is essentially asset management. She is the leader of a group of accountants who are the employees of the foundation and who manage the endowment and the funds coming in. So these two jobs are different, though obviously related. And so I don't think it's any different than, say, an employee wearing two hats, two different companies. Somebody could be, say, a lawyer at a law firm and also maybe an officer of an LLC owned by their spouse, but it doesn't mean that the law firm controls the LLC owned by the spouse. The jobs are considered to be different, and things can be possessed in different capacities. So I hope that won't offend the university, Your Honor. So ultimately here, there's a trial. In the pretrial briefing, argued significantly, does the university control the foundation? Pages 18 to 20 of the petitioner's pretrial brief, pages 14 and 15 of ours, the foundation said we are not the agent of the university. When we came to the trial, there's testimony about that from Susan Van Loonen, the CFO of the foundation, and she is asked, does the university control the foundation? She testifies no. She's asked, does the university control the disbursement of funds from the foundation? She testifies no, they cannot do that. And so the trial court finds the foundation is operating independently, and that is adequate to separate it from the university sufficiently under FOIA. Now, just one final point. It's worth mentioning, I think, why these foundations exist in general. Your Honor mentioned something like that, but the key, I think, it's not FOIA. Many of them predate FOIA. They exist because public bodies have significant limits placed by statute on what they can do with money in their possession. And so it's the Investment of Public Funds Act. Governments don't invest in the stock market, essentially. So these private funds, foundations, exist to pool private money in private hands and under private control. That's why the General Assembly has encouraged them to exist. And they do that so that they can manage that money consistent with these long time horizons, significant pools of money, and what's better for everyone in the long run. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Toby Heitens on behalf of George Mason University. It is common ground in this case that GMU is a public body for purposes of FOIA, and that as a result, records that are prepared by, or in the possession of George Mason University are potentially subject to FOIA. But the converse is also true. This Court has said, most recently in the American Tradition case, that Virginia's version of the Freedom of Information Act applies only to public records that are in the custody of public bodies.
Do you agree with your colleagues that the RFP decision would be cited exactly the same way after 2001?
I agree that the outcome would be the same, Justice Kelsey. I don't think the Court has to answer that question, but I think it would be decided the same way.
So the 2001 amendment then was purely wordsmithing, added no additional substantive content to the statute?
I'm not sure that I would say that it added literally no content. I think Mr. Fitzgerald is right that to the extent one can extrapolate from the text of that statute, a clear intent is an intent to say we're not going to debate whether the entity that is, whether something that is an entity of something else. We're not going to debate whether it's technically a committee or a subcommittee, if it is an entity of the public body.
Isn't that broader than a pure agency relationship? Because the entity is an entity that's performing delegated functions.
Well, Justice Kelsey, before we even get to whether it's performing public functions, there's a question of whether it is an entity of the public body. And I think our friends on the other side are essentially seeking to ignore the word entity of. They're saying entity that performs delegated public functions. But that's not what the statute says. The statute says entity of the public body that is performing a delegated
public function. So when there's a symbiotic relationship as deep as this one, the thumb on the scale, the liberal construction thumb on the scale, doesn't affect anything?
I'm not saying that it doesn't affect anything, Justice Kelsey, but as this court said in the Daily Press, liberal construction is one thing, expanding the statute behind the apparent purpose of the General Assembly is another. I have had someone look into this in preparing this argument. By my count, this court has decided 23 cases about the scope of disclosure required under FOIA. In 15 of those 23 cases, the court has held that disclosure was not required under FOIA. Now, that isn't to say that this court wasn't applying the liberal construction principle. It's just to say that the liberal construction principle cannot be an all-purpose the petitioners always win whenever they can make an argument that wouldn't be sanctionable. The court has an obligation to construe the statute, and if and only if, after the process of construing the statute, the court is left with an ambiguity, then the principle of liberal construction comes in. Justice Kelsey, you asked earlier about 2.23705.4, and I understand that our friends on the other side make the argument that it says by or for. I think the function of that is once we are dealing with a public record held by a public body. So this is the gift acceptance committee example that the circuit court said. So if the foundation goes out and generates records raising money for the university, and if those records then come into the custody and possession of the university, they would be public records that are subject to FOIA. And what that provision is designed to do is to say, one thing that's a little bit strange about the reliance on that provision, of course, is that is an exclusion from FOIA. That's a provision that says even if this is a public record held by the public body, it doesn't have to necessarily be disclosed
in
total.
Is that right? Even if it is? I thought an exemption presupposes the rule. You could write 1,000, I don't know if the rule applies or not, but here's 1,000 exemptions if it were to apply.
Sure. And Justice Kelsey, I completely agree with you that there are circumstances under which fundraising records involving, records involving fundraising by or for a public institution of higher education, there are circumstances in which that could be a public record. And the example is the one that the circuit court gave, which is to say if the foundation goes out and raises money for George Mason University, that's not a public record yet. But if at some point that record makes its way into the possession or files of the university, that record is a public record under FOIA.
To use the language literally, your interpretation would be the foundation does not maintain, in connection with fundraising activities, documents for the university.
No, Justice Kelsey, that wouldn't be my view. My view would be that when the foundation has them, they are not public records in the custody of a public body, and that's necessary in order to get to the public records question in the first place.
Then why is the word for there? It would just be documents maintained by the university?
Because, Justice Kelsey, at some point those records could make their way to the custody and possession of the university, and once that happens, they are in the possession of the university for purposes of the public records definition. I mean, that's actually one of the examples. There was some discussion, there's some references in the briefs, the fact that the university originally concluded that it didn't have any responsive records. And then the circuit court notes in its opinion, at one point the university did disclose some records that it concluded that it had erroneously missed. My understanding is that was the nature of the records that the university eventually produced in this case, was there were records that had made their way to the possession of the university, and the university concluded that those records were required to be disclosed under FOIA, and they were disclosed. So I don't think it reads that portion out of the statute in any way, shape, or form. Now, if I could mention briefly Dr. Bingham, I think it's very critical here to focus on the allegation that is actually in the amended petition. It's on page JA 173. It's paragraph 91 of the amended petition. This is the critical allegation involving Dr. Bingham. The records described in the request are public records because they are in the possession of and or used by Dr. Bingham, who is a public body's officer, employee, or agent, both of which are forms of public business, for the benefit of the university. That is not an allegation of agency. That is an allegation that someone has something for someone else's benefit. But the language of agency, right, for language of the agency would be on behalf of or subject to the control of. And I don't think that's a minor point because it sort of explodes the narrowness. I mean, our friends on the other side, I think, are a little bit inconsistent about whether they're arguing that FOIA applies to all of these foundations or if only it applies to this one specific foundation. But I think by alleging there that it's enough to bring them within the agency to allege that Dr. Bingham possesses them for the benefit of the university, that's an argument that every single foundation record is subject to FOIA. And the way that I know that is if you look at 23.1.10.10.3, where the General Assembly specifically authorizes universities to, quote, create or continue the existence of nonprofit entities for the purpose of soliciting, accepting, managing, or administering grants. Every single thing these foundations do can be described as ultimately for the benefit of the university. So if that is sufficient to allege agency, then they're alleging agency with regard to every single one of these. And that's what I think is the central question in this case. We think that this case ultimately presents a straightforward and ultimately easily resolved who decides question. The particular foundation at issue in this case existed 2 years before Virginia's FOIA statute was enacted. And for the last 50 years, no one, not this court, not the Attorney General, and not the FOIA Advisory Council, has ever suggested that under current law, these foundation records are already subject to FOIA. The General Assembly has repeatedly considered proposals to expand FOIA to reach these records, and it may well do so again in the future and make a different choice. But as this court emphasized most recently in the Daily Press decision, where to draw that line is a question of legislation, not litigation, and because the Circuit Court properly respected that distinction, its decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you. Very briefly, Justice Kelsey, I did want to clarify my answer to your question about if RFP was decided today. I actually think that the ultimate decision in that case would be the same, because before going into the veil-piercing analysis, the court did note that the entity in that case was not created for the purpose of performing a delegated function. And so I think that would still take the facts of that case outside of the statute as it stands now. However, in this case, we do have undisputed evidence that the sole reason that the foundation was formed was to perform this delegated function on behalf of the university. I also want to be very clear about the nature of the Circuit Court's decision below. The Circuit Court was clear in its letter opinion that it was making its decision based on unstipulated facts. It was deciding a pure matter of law. It thought that our stipulation that the foundation is a separate legal entity that has its own bylaws, its own board of trustees, its own charter was dispositive of the case. And that is the only issue that the Circuit Court addressed and ruled on. The evidence as to the university's control was at best mixed at that hearing. There was evidence that the university writes in its own financial statements that it considers the foundation a component unit, meaning that it has...
Would the question of control be a factual one after a hearing? So I understand, I mean, that's a great closing argument, but the decision of the trial court was not without some factual basis, in fact, ample factual basis. And so I'll just say, sitting where I sit, I might have agreed with you, given the conflicting evidence at trial, but here we are with an adverse finding. How can I say, I'm going to knock that out and say, no, in fact, there was agency?
Because the court didn't actually address the evidence of control. It wasn't necessary for its decision. It made no factual findings by its own terms in the letter opinion. It was strictly deciding a matter of law based on stipulated facts that the parties had agreed to. I also want to note very quickly that I believe that the university has really conflated two of the claims here in citing to the claim regarding Dr. Bingham as somehow relevant to this question of agency. Actually, our allegations related to agency are in a completely different count. What was merely alleged there was just that
Janet Bingham was an officer of the university and used the records in that capacity for the ultimate benefit, certainly, but the agency question isn't implicated necessarily by that count. I see that my time is running out. Unless the court has any questions, we will ask it to reverse the decision below. Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.